last week. So the last thing we defined was the notion of a category. So it's like something which has objects, which we usually call X, Y, Z, and so on. And then there's some morphisms which go from X to Y. And we have composition and so on. And the next remark is just some introduction of useful notation, more or less. So the statement is so the composition we will draw as a composition. We will draw something like this. So if I draw something which looks like this, then I do this 2D node, the composition. F decomposed with F, and then in addition we say a square. Well, we say the square or similar diagrams commute, so square something like this. So I have draw a diagram of morphisms which looks like this. So I have F and G, which I can compose to get a map from X to Z. And in addition, I have a map, which is the composition of H with K, which also goes from X to Z. And I say this square commutes if they agree. So if F composed with G is equal to H composed with K. Okay, and as a simple example, recall that last time we have introduced for any finite group a category BG, which only had one object and the morphisms were element in a group, and composition was given by multiplication. So if I ask if something like this diagram commutes, then this commutes if and only if G and H commute. So GH is equal to HG. Okay.
Oh, sorry, the morphism here is just a group action by
element? Like, this is a category where so the objects in BG, there's just one, which I call star. And then the morphisms in BG are just the group element of G. And composition of morphisms is given by group multiplication. This is one of the examples from last week. And then the composition, right? If I compose these two things, I get G times H. If I compose them, I get H times G. So for this to be equal, the two elements in the group need to commute. Okay. So far we have introduced what categories are, and now the next thing we want to define is a way of comparing them. And I should also say again, what we are trying to do is to build up to the definition of a topological field theory as something comparing a category of geometric flavor, which comes from Bordisms, to a category of algebraic or flavor, which is given by vector spaces. So we want to somehow say it's like a quantum field theory is something which relates topology to algebra in a certain sense. And we are just trying to set up the terminology to actually say what this means. So the first thing is just if we have two categories, then what does it mean to relate them? So let C and D be categories. And the notion of a relation between categories is that of a functor. So a functor F, which we will denote similar to maps, so it's something which goes from C to D, and then this consists of the following things. First of all, an object F of C, which is an object of D, and such an object for all C and C. So it just says F, given an object in C, it maps it to some object in D. And in addition, we have a morphism F of F, which is now a morphism in D, which goes from the source of F, so small f, we apply large f to it, to the target of f, and we want this for all morphisms f in C. So this just means if I have a morphism in f, I can apply a functor to it to get a morphism between the image of a source and the image of this target. And these things should now be compatible with the structure we had before, or the structure of a category more explicitly. So there are two conditions we asked. First of all, if I apply F to a composition of morphisms, then I want this to be the composition of the corresponding morphisms. And the other condition is that if I apply it to an identity at an object X, let's call it C, then I want to get map this to the identity at F of C. Okay? So that that's going to be exciting. Okay, so let's do a few examples. So we have seen last week that there's a category of vector spaces, where the objects are vector spaces and the morphisms are linear maps. And what I can do is I can take a vector space and forget that it's a vector space and just consider the underlying set. And I can take a linear map and forget that it's linear and it's still a map of sets. This just sends V to V, and F will be sent to F from V to W, but this is somehow forgetting the linear structure. This is like maybe a stupid example, but it's sometimes useful to argue certain things. And then another question or another example is, we have seen that there's this category BG, which again has one object and G has morphisms, and we can ask what's the functor from here to vector spaces. So let's call this thing rho. What it will do is it will take the one point we have in here and maps it to some vector space, let's call it V. And then for every morphism in here, which is a morphism from the point to itself, it will map it to a linear map from V to V. And one of the relations this has to satisfy is that it's compatible with the composition. So what I get is rho GH as a linear map should be rho of G times rho of H. And in addition, we have rho of the identity element should be the identity on V. Okay, and this is something you know under a different name, right? It's just rho is the representation of G. Representation.
Okay. What's the name of BG again? Like, if I should say, it's not the category of groups, it's the category of the group. How do I call it? BG is a.
I mean, it's the, it's like a category associated to a group somehow.
Okay. So it's got no special name, okay.
BG. I mean, there are other things people call BG. There's the thing in topology called BG, which is the classifying space, which is related to this category. If your group is finite, there's a way to go from categories to spaces. And if you apply this to this category I call BG, then the space you will get is the classifying space for the group. And this is why there's this notation. But here it just means it's like somehow something with one object and G has automorphisms. Okay. But so functors from this thing to vector spaces are the same as are the same as representations. So you can also now ask what's a G representation on something more fancy than a vector space. Maybe you want to act on a topological space or an algebraic variety or whatever. And you should always think of it as a functor from this BG to whatever category or thing you want to act on listen.
Sorry, this is just something I missed. When you say S of F, you just mean like the domain of F, right?
Yeah, S of F is the domain, T of F is the
target.
Yeah, T stands for target, S stands for source. Domain, yeah. Target, okay. Okay, and now the next example somehow comes in form of a small proposition. It just states that there is a category of, and I should add some word. Small, just meaning that the objects and morphisms form a set. Categories and functors. So the objects here in this category are categories themselves, and the morphisms are functors between those. And why is this something one needs to check? So there's like something one should check, and the first thing is I should tell you how functors compose. So the important thing is that I should somehow define what F composed with G, which now should go from, so let's fix that F C to D, and G D to E, the functors. Okay, and then what we should define is what is the composition F composed with G. It should go from C to E is defined by, so if I evaluate this on an object C, I just define this as G evaluated on whatever C. So I apply F to C, this gives me an object in D, and now I apply G to this. And for morphisms, I do the same. So it's more or less what you think. I mean, what you would probably have guessed anyway. So this is G evaluated on F of F, which by definition will now go from G composed with F, source of F, to the same thing with the target of F. Okay. And now you should check that there's a unit for, so it's an identity for this, and that it's associative and so on, but this is clear, so we leave the rest as an exercise. So it's it's more or less straightforward now to verify that with this definition, these things actually form a category. Okay. And now we can do some more examples of functors. The statement is that there is a functor which goes from categories to groupoids. So groupoids is now just the subcategory of the category of categories where the objects are groupoids, meaning categories where every morphism is an isomorphism. And what I can do is I can send a category to its maximal subgroupoid and get a functor from categories to to groupoids. And here there's one statement hidden in this example, namely that if I have a functor between two categories, it induces a functor between the maximal subgroupoids, meaning that it preserves isomorphisms. And this is should be easy to check, or is easy to check. Let's maybe just.
Sorry, can you repeat that claim?
The claim is, let's just check this. So if I have f, which goes from C to D, and f from, let's say, x to y in C is an isomorphism. And this implies f of f is iso in D. And how do you see that? It's just, so you need to show that there's an inverse for f of f. And I claim the inverse is just f applied to the inverse in C. So how can we check that this is an inverse? We use the condition here that if I compose the images at the same as the composition of the original thing, this is f of f composed with f inverse. And then meaning that this is an inverse means that this composition is the identity. So it's f at the identity at source, wait, target of f. And this is by the other condition we had here, that every functor has to preserve identities. This is the identity at f of target of f. And that there's also a left inverse, you can check exactly the same way. And this shows that every functor here actually induces a functor between the maxima subgroupoids. Okay.
So just so, so you're mapping the category to another category where you simply remove all the morphisms that are not invertible, I presume.
Yes, I just remove all non-invertible morphisms.
Yeah, okay.
This is about like something we did at the end of last time, last lecture of the last lecture. Okay. More examples of categories and functors. I mean, all these things seem probably quite abstract now, but they are things we will use later. So it somehow seems good to introduce them in the more abstract setting so that we can use apply them when we start studying topological field theories without then distracting from what's actually going on. So there's another probably quite abstract example. Now 1.9. So let C be a category. Then we define C op. This is now a new category to be the category so the category has the same object as C with the same objects as C. And so the objects, we just again call them X, Y, and so on. And then the morphisms. Now we introduce things we call F op, which go from Y. So we introduce a morphism we call f op from y to x for every morphism f from x to y in C. So what this does, it's like I take a morphism from something to something else, and I put in a morphism going the other direction. So I reverse the direction of all my morphisms. And this defines a new category where the composition is defined in the following way. If I have morphisms G op, F op, which go from Z to Y to X, then this composition is defined to be the map from Z to X, which is given by composing the other maps the other direction. So I do first F, then G, and then I do op. So if I compose F with G, this is a map from X to Z. So it defines a map from Z to X in the opposite category. And why do I mention this? This is somehow, there are some, one often comes across operations which somehow are not covariant in the direction of morphisms, but contravariant. So they reverse the direction. And the first example one probably knows is in, can now be encoded in a functor. So there's a functor from the category of vector spaces to the category of vector spaces op, which sends, which I call something like star, and it sends a vector space to its dual, which is just defined as the maps from V to C or whatever our field is. And now if I have a map F, which goes from V to W, then F star, there's an adjoint map, which goes from W star to V star. So taking a dual reverses the direction in which maps go. And you can encode this into a functor which goes from vector spaces to the opposite of vector spaces. Okay.
Maybe one question. I don't know, maybe you had one. So it seems like, okay, so op is a functor. Maybe I missed that, the wrong word.
It's you can think of it as a functor from categories to categories, which sends a category, right? We have seen over there, there is a category of categories, and then taking the opposite gives a functor from categories to categories, yeah.
Okay.
That's what you...
Yes, and what I'm just trying to think about whether, for instance, the dual functor is a... It feels almost like, I want to say something like it's a representation of op or something like that. You know, it's not the op itself, but it's rather a way to induce something that flips arrows, but I'm getting confused about it.
Yeah, I mean, that's why, that's what it means somehow, right? It's like, I mean, it's something which goes from vect to vect, but it flips the direction of arrows, so you need to use the opposite here because maps compose in the other direction.
I was just asking what the free operation.
The one which takes the dual.
So, just the English for what is in letter? Is that all?
Oh, it's homomorphism, I think.
Oh.
Ah, yeah, this means homomorphisms.
The superscript.
It's a star. Opposite. I'm sorry. I mean, this is not an English problem. This is a handwriting problem. And this means opposite for the opposite category.
Why is all a function from cat to cat? Should it be inverse direction of functors?
It's a fun exercise. So let's say I have a functor f from C to D, right? And now I want to define something I call f op.
And that still goes from C op to D op.
And this still goes from C op to D op. What it does, I mean, it sends the morphism f op to f of f op. And this still preserves the direction of composition because somehow you reverse both of those. Fun thing, I don't know if it's fun, but in a few definitions, we will also introduce something, a type of morphisms between functors. And then you can ask, what does this operation does with this operation of so-called natural transformations? And that will actually reverse the direction. This is a bit far ahead. Let me erase this. Okay. So more examples. No, I guess 10. So if I have a category C, for any category C, I can look at a function and I fix an object in this category, and then I can look at maps out of this object. This is a functor from C to set. And what it does, it sends an object. So if I have some D and C, I just send it to the set. So C should be small here. I send it to the set of morphisms from C to D. So this is the notation for like the set of all F from C to D. F is in more C. Okay, and now if I have a functor, a morphism in C which goes from a D to a D prime, I map it to the map. So I now need this map, I need to map it to a map of sets, which goes from HOM C D to HOM C D prime. What I do is if I have a map F from C to D, H from C to D, I map it to, first I do H and then I do F to D prime. And then this is what one would usually call F lower star, so it's a push forward along F. And now, similarly, the HOM blank into C now defines a functor from C op to set, and F will be mapped to what one might call a pullback, which is usually reverses the order of composition. Okay.
Just another example. Is there any small lessons I can take or something? I don't know.
I don't know. It turns out these things are extremely useful to have. So if we were to do a proper course on category theory, this would be, now talk about the thing called the Yoneda lemma, which I will not do, but the Yoneda lemma, right, a functor which looks like this, it's called representable. It's represented by such an object, and the Yoneda lemma somehow tells you something hard to say now. But if I look, one way of thinking about it is this functor. Yeah, I mean, let me say it this way: knowing this functor, which goes from C to set, completely characterizes C.
Yeah.
So you can somehow know what an object is by just knowing how it talks to all other objects. So you just need, I don't know, like if someone went to the colloquium on Wednesday, there was this Leibniz philosophy, and which somehow says you can, to understand an object, you just need to understand how it sits in relation to all other objects. And this somehow uniquely characterizes it. And this is a setting here. So if I want to know what C is in this category, it's, I can equivalently specify just the information of what maps out of it or into it, so how it relates to all other things. And then sometimes it's easier to check certain properties for maps out of an object or for these representable functors. I think there was a reason I introduced them, because I wanted to use them a bit.
Okay.
I'm sorry, can you explain more what the difference between representable and irrepresentable, I guess? Like what kind of functors are not of that one?
Sure. I mean, generally, it's a hard question, but I mean, is it? I mean, for example, this is okay. This one is representable. It's represented by k. So you hom into k.
Yes. For the op functor for the smooth manifolds, it's not representable.
Yes.
The op functor taking the opposite of the category.
Yeah, or if you reverse the orientation, I mean, yeah, if you, you think this is an easy example, right, I mean, for example, equivalences are not so often representable. Like if I, right, you can ask, let me say, like for example, we can ask which things from BG to sets are representable, right? So I said these things are representations, and this has only one object, so there's only one representable map. And this sends the point to G itself, and then this is with its like left action via, with its usual action via left multiplication. So G acts on itself by multiplication. It's like free and transitive, and this is the only G representation which would be representable. I mean, this is somehow called the regular representation. But all the other representations will all not be representable. I mean, yeah, in a certain sense, representable things generate all things. So you can, somehow anything you can do from a category to two sets, you can reconstruct by like gluing together representable ones. You know, this is like if you study sheaves in an abstract setting, that's what you do. But also, I should highlight, right, representability only works for functors to set. I mean, and there maybe if the category is a, has the morphism space have some additional structure, you might be able to go somewhere else. But as soon as I want a functor to something which is not set, like it doesn't even make sense to ask about representability. Right? You can talk about functors to set, but most interesting functors are not going to the category of sets. They somehow go somewhere else. If that helps. More definitions. Yes, I said. Now, functors, there's a way of comparing functors themselves. So there's a way of relating them to each other. So, and this is what's called a natural transformation. So we fix f and g functors from C to D. Functors from C to D. And then we define what's called a natural transformation. Transformation eta, which goes from F to G. And we use this double arrow symbol to denote natural transformations. And this consists of the following thing. It's a map eta C from F of C. Right, note that this is an object in D. So I can talk about morphisms between this thing and other objects of D to G of C. And we want this for all objects C in see. And then there's a condition, which is that this is compatible with the value of F and G homomorphisms, meaning meaning that the following diagram commutes. So if I'm at F of C, I can do eta C to go to F to G of C. But I can also take a morphism from C to some other object, which I call C prime, and evaluate F on it, and then do the natural transformation at C prime to go to G of C prime, and then I can do G of F. And I have now these two maps which go from F of C to G of C prime, and I want this to commute. For all f from C to C prime in C. Okay. And this means these are some operations which are compatible with the way things are related. Okay, now an example. For those is I can take the category of vector spaces, and then I can now go to the category of vector spaces again by taking the double dual. Right? Taking a dual once reverses the direction of morphisms, and then if I take the dual again, I'm back with the original direction. And then on the other hand, I also have the identity. And now there's a natural transformation between those, which, if I have a vector space, there's always a canonical map to its double dual, which just thinks of it as you take an element in the dual, and then a dual of that you can do by evaluating it on the original thing. And this is generally not an isomorphism. But if the vector spaces are finite dimensional, then this map turns out to be an isomorphism. It's something I should have added here. Eta is a natural isomorphism if eta C is an isomorphism for all C. So then we call this a natural isomorphism. Okay, and now let's look also at our other favorite example, which is maps out of BG. So we take two representations from G to vect, and then we ask what's the natural transformation eta from rho to rho prime. And what does it consist of? I mean, there's only one object in here, so I only need to give one map from rho of the point to rho prime of the point. So I will need to give a map f, which goes from the vector space underlying v to the vector space underlying v prime. And then there's this naturality condition, which just means that if I do f, and I do rho of g, and I compose them, then this is the same as doing rho prime of g after f. And these type of things is exactly what's known as a map, as like an intertrinar of representations, or morphism of representations. So in this sense, functors out of BG describe representations, and natural transformations between them describe what the natural notion of maps between representations. And this example broadly generalizes.
I missed the point of eta, the natural the natural isomorphism.
Yeah.
Like from this example, looks like it's a way of, I think I just missed the point of eta. Like, what is it doing to the...
Right, it takes a vec, you mean here, or?
Yeah, sure.
So you need, right? You need to give a map from V to V double dual for all vector spaces. And what it does, right, I take a small V and I need to take it to a map, which, so I take in some function, which is a function from V to K, and needs to give me back, needs to map this function to a number. And what I can do is I can take this function, I need to map it to a number. The number I map it to is I take this function and I evaluate it on small v. So there's always a natural map from a vector space into its double dual. However, this is only an isomorphism if v is finite dimensional. But it's always natural. If I have a map from V to some W, then there's also a map F double star, and the corresponding diagram will commute. And a natural isomorphism between functors, you really means that the two functors are the same. Right? There's, you cannot really distinguish them. It's like, right here, if two representations are isomorphic, then they describe the same type of information. They might show up in a different way in your setting, but anything meaningfully you can ask about one representation or the other one will give the same answer. And there's somehow this generalization of having two functors which essentially do the same. So you can identify them with each other. And for this, it's important to be this thing to be an isomorphism, because otherwise there might be a relation, but they might do different things on different.
In the case of the double dual, what are the two functors that are being equated? The identity?
The identity. So this just sends a vector space to itself and linear map to itself and the functor, which is the double dual. Okay.
For the case of the group presentation, so we can also have intertwiners between different groups, right?
Yeah.
Can we express them also in terms of metric transformations?
Right, if you want to have an intertwiner between representations of different groups, you need to first give a map between the groups, right? Because otherwise, what do you mean with, right? If I have a group G and a group H,
I suppose, of course.
And I have a G and an H representation, I don't know what it means, but if I have a map from G to H, then you can ask if the representations are somehow related. Right? And what you can do is so there's a map, a group homomorphism from G to H, and uses a functor from BG to BH. Now I have a functor 2 vect from here, which is a representation of G. I have a functor from H to here, which is a representation of H. I can compose these two functors and ask for a natural transformation to this, which would explain how you can talk about intertwiners for different groups. Okay. Now, I mean, this example here already showed hint to the fact that if I have two categories, the functors between them will again form a category. And this is exactly the next example. So let C and C prime be categories. There is a category consisting of functors from C to C prime. Okay. Yeah, I think I call this D. There's this category with objects and functors. F from C to D and morphisms, natural transformations Okay, and now I should say what's the composition of two natural transformations. So I have some eta, which goes from f to g, and some eta prime, which goes f g h. So I have some eta prime here. Then I need to tell you what is the composition at an object, and this is just the composition d. So eta prime composed with eta. I need to specify what this does at an object C. And this is just, I go from f of C, I can apply the natural transformation eta at C, which goes to g of C. And now I can apply the natural transformation eta prime at C, which goes to h of C. And then naturality is just that. I will need to check that a diagram which looks like this commutes, but I already know this diagram commutes and this one commutes. So this composition is the same as this one, but then this one is also the same as this one. So you can see that the outer composition is also the same. And as a picture, we will draw them the following thing. So I have C and D, and then I have F, G, and H. And I have natural transformations eta and eta prime. And then there's the composition of these two things. So this is just a picture for this type of operation. And this again defines a category. And now there's a question for you to think about, which we will probably do at a later point, but it's an exercise which is just somehow makes sense. Right, this picture somehow puts these things next to each other, top to bottom, but you might also consider putting them together in a horizontal way, so it's supposed to make sense. Like what a picture like this means. So I now have f and g, f prime, g prime, and then natural transformations epsilon and eta between them. And now there should be some type of horizontal operation here. Okay. Questions?
Yeah, no, I'm failing to grasp what's the message of this example. So there's a category from. We're trying to build this a two category thing.
It's saying that if you look at the category of categories and morphisms in there, there's actually relations between those given by natural transformations, which is what's called a two category. I'm not built into this. Just saying if you have two categories and look at functors between them, then they naturally form a category themselves. So they have a notion of maps. Okay, so maybe.
And these natural transformations are the notion of maps between functors.
Yes. Exactly. And why you might care about this, I should probably have done more physics in here. Later on, I hope apparently not today, but next week, we will define a topological field theory to be a functor from a Bordism category to some category of vector spaces. And then you can, for example, define a symmetry of a theory to just be a natural isomorphism from it to itself, because that's the right notion of what it means to be the same somehow symmetry. And now you can even do more, right? What does it mean to act with a group on a topological quantum field theory is now an easy thing, because it's just a functor from BG to the category of functors from board to vect. Because TFTs are elements in this functor category. And then if I want to act with G on this, I just say it's a functor to whatever the thing is living in. So this is like an easy way of defining what it means to have a symmetry of a quantum field theory. Or even, this is, I think I'm overselling the point a bit, but there are these things called dualities, which usually say to you there are two different ways of describing the same field theory. And it's like sometimes might be hard to say what this means. But in the topological setting, it really means there are somehow two ways of constructing a field theory like this, and then there's a natural isomorphism between them, which implements the duality. And it's, so it's somehow a good language to formulate these type of questions about field theories. Because otherwise, I don't know, what does it mean to act on a quantum field theory? I mean, on a classical field theory, it might be easy to say, but so for example here, I don't know if we do that, but if we ask what are symmetries of Diagraph-Witten series, there's somehow some which come from actions on the classical fields, but then there are also things which are called, or things which are like electromagnetic dualities, which give you isomorphisms between certain functors, but you can really only see them at the quantum level and not, there's nothing classical corresponding to them. And there you can make, like for this Diagraph-Witten series, you can make well-defined statements. So you can actually say what you mean when you say these things. And also this is somehow, right here, after having the setup, there's somehow no guessing. Right, this is what it should be, and it's easy. Oh, it's like it's clear to define. So I'm like, well, the point I'm trying to make is that this turns out to just be a good language to formulate problems. Right, category theory is usually not good to solve problems. It's good to formulate problems. So what it does for you, it's usually it the things which are easy, it makes clearly easy. And then it leaves you with the hard stuff, which you still have to work on. Okay.
So maybe a couple of things. Two things. I don't understand the problem, the exercise. And maybe another thing you mentioned is that the natural transformations define some sort of sameness between functors.
Yes.
The notion of sameness. There's no invertibility notion, though, right? So it's
I mean, it's right. It's somehow natural transformations describe relations between functors. And then natural isomorphisms say sameness. Right? It's like you can have intertwiners between representations. It doesn't mean that they are the same. But then you can also have isomorphisms between representations, meaning that they are the same.
Okay. So this would be the equivalent of a homomorphism, not an isomorphism.
Yeah, exactly. Right? The natural transformation is just a homomorphism or intertwiner. A natural isomorphism would be an isomorphism of representations.
Sure.
And the exercise, I mean, like I somehow here I tried to explain that this picture is what we did here. And now I'm just encouraging you to ask, what is this picture? Like there's a picture I can draw, and now there's the question, is there a meaning for that? And I mean the answer, I mean, it would be a really bad exercise if the answer is no. So the answer will be yes, there's like a way how you can compose natural transformations horizontally. More questions. Okay. And now, so we have figured out what it means for functors to be the same. And you might think, okay, we also know what it means for categories to be the same. It's just that there's functor from C to D and a functor the other direction, so that the composition is the identity. But then the question is, what do we mean with is the identity? I mean, do we mean it's strictly the identity? Or maybe do we only mean it's naturally isomorphic to the identity? Because here I tried to argue that being naturally isomorphic, we should think of as being the same, even though the isomorphism might be non-trivial. And it turns out that the notion where we strictly require it to be the identity is way, it's not a good notion, and the better one is where you require there to be isomorphic things. And this is like the concept of an equivalence. Okay, I should probably give up numbering things because I'm not saying much. But so we say a functor f from C to D is an equivalence if there exists a functor F inverse from D to C and natural Isomorphisms. F inverse composed with F to the identity on C, and F composed with F inverse to the identity on D. So we take the notion of isomorphism we had before, but now instead of requiring this to be equal to the identity, we only require it to be naturally isomorphic. Okay. And now there's a question you should at least ponder a bit. It's like, we have seen that isomorphisms are unique, and you might ask, oh, how unique is the inverse? And then you might easily convince yourself it's unique up to natural isomorphism. But then I also say there are these isomorphisms. And there might be situations where you actually want to specify them. But then you should also ask, how unique are they? And this turns out to be a slightly more tricky question, because if you specify them just as natural isomorphisms, they will not be unique. There will be different choices. And there might be situations where your choices give you different answers. But then there's like an improvement of this notion, which also requires some compatibility between the two things, making them unique again. I don't know. This is, yeah. Sometimes it's useful. Most of the time it can be ignored. If we will need it, we will. I will go through the details.
So is it true that natural isomorphism is when both directions are natural transformations?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. Nice exercise. This is right here. I say it's eta c, and then I say it's invertible pointwise. So I have maps going here, maps going here. But then you asked, oh, does this diagram commute? And it does, but it's not completely obvious. I mean, but yes, the other direction is also an inverse. So it means natural isomorphisms are actually the isomorphisms in the category of functors. But there are things where, it's right. There are things where this is not. I mean, there are situations where arguments like this fail. The easiest thing is topological spaces, right? You know, if you ask the continuous map between topological spaces to be a bijection, it doesn't mean it's a homeomorphism, because even though there is an inverse, the inverse might fail to be smooth. Right, and this could happen here as well, right? There is an inverse pointwise, but it somehow fails to be natural, but it doesn't. Here it's all good, but something to be careful about. Okay, now I should go. And I also wanted to mention we had this functor somewhere, which takes the vector space to its dual vector space. And this, on finite dimensional vector spaces, defines an equivalence between between vector spaces and the opposite of vector spaces. There's a bit more formal stuff we need to do. And then probably next week we start to do more topology and field theories. But the next thing we need to understand is what the monoidal category. And this is somehow trying to make the following observation precise, that if I have two vector spaces, V and W, I can form their tensor product. And if I have two manifolds, sigma and sigma prime, I can form their disjoint union. And in the last lecture we have seen, we want to say somehow this operation of disjoint unions corresponds to the operation of taking the tensor product. And for this, it's just important to understand what this operation means. So how, what does the construction of taking two things and building a new thing mean? And how can we compare different type of these things, right? Here we want to compare geometric thing to something algebraic later. And to state the definition, so, and this can be, operations like this can be abstracted into the notion of a monoidal category. So it's a category together with some type of binary operation. But to say what a binary operation is, we first need some, like one other definition, which is, so if I have two categories, C and D, then we define a new category, which we call C times D. So this is just supposed to encode the notion of having an object in C and an object in D together, like pairs of objects. So this has, again, some objects and morphisms. So objects and morphisms. And they are given, the objects are given by pairs C and D, which are just elements in the Cartesian project product of the objects in C and the objects in D. And morphisms are also pairs of morphisms, F, G in morphisms of C times morphisms of D. Respectively. Okay. And then to specify source and target, so if I have a pair F and G, this is a morphism from the pair C, D to C prime, D prime, where F goes from C to C prime, and G goes from D to D prime. So just taking pairs of maps. And then composition is just given by composition in the original category. This really is just a new category you can form by just taking the two old ones and putting them next together. Okay. Probably not that exciting, but now we can define what a monoidal category is. So, a monoidal category consists of the following data. So first it's a category C, then an object 1 in C. So this is something like a monoidal, or this is something like a unit for this operation, then, or for the tensor product operation, then an operation we call tensor product, so it's a functor which goes from C times C to C. So that's why I defined this categorical product here, and just to say what the tensor product is, so it takes in two objects of C and gives me back one object, and then there are also and natural isomorphisms. The following one. So if I have C, I can take this fixed object 1 and take the Cartesian product with it, which maps from C to C. So this defines a functor from this category to the product. It just puts in 1 into this slot. And then I can apply the tensor product and go back to C. On the other side, I also have the identity here, and I want a natural isomorphism, which I call R. So what is the component of this at an object? So R at C is a natural isomorph, is a map from one tensor C to C. So this means tensoring with one on the left is the same as just doing nothing. So one is a unit for this tensor product. Then there's the same natural transformation for the other side. So I do something tensor one and apply the tensor product. To the identity which we call L. And now the last piece of information is we want this operation of tensoring things together to be associative. So if I have three objects X, Y, and Z, I can take their tensor product in two orders. And I want these things to be the same, but being the same should be now implemented via an isomorphism. So this is what this last piece of structure encodes, which is called, it's usually called an associator, which will exactly be a natural transformation implementing this type of relation. What type of natural transformation is it? A natural isomorphism. It's like I now have three objects, so I have three copies of C. Then I can apply the tensor product to the first two copies and the identity on the second copy, which goes to C times C. And then I do the tensor product again to C, or I do it the other way. So it's this identity times tensor product, and then I apply the tensor product. Okay, and then there's a natural isomorphism filling this diagram, which is called alpha, or people usually call this an associator, because it implements associativity. So let me rephrase what type of data is. This is an ordinary category C, which has some specified object one, a type of monoidal product, which takes in two objects in C and gives back a new object. Because it's a functor, it can also tensor together morphisms. And then it has information saying us that one is a unit, both from the left and from the right, and information specifying that this is associative. But now these things still have to satisfy some conditions. Namely, if, for example, if I now look at four elements, I can somehow relate them in different ways using the associativity, and we want them to be the same. So there are two conditions they have to satisfy. So we have all this data, and now there are conditions. The first one is that left and right units are compatible. So if I look at an expression like this, where I take x, tensor with the unit with y, I can just do the right at x, and then I tensor with y, tensor with the identity on y. This gives me a map from here to x tensor y. I can also use alpha at x, 1, and y, which is a natural transformation from this bracketing to the other bracketing. And then I can use left at x. And I want this to be the same. So somehow there are two ways I can remove this 1, which are both implemented by isomorphisms. And if I want to remove a 1, I don't want to keep track which one I use, so I require them to be the same. And then the other thing, which is usually called, which is called the pentagon condition, means that if I have four objects, I want the ways of using alphas to relate them to not matter. So I have something like W, tensor X, tensor Y, tensor Z. And now there are a lot of different ways of bracketing this. So we start with the way where all brackets are to the left. And now I can apply alpha at W tensor X. This is an object in C. Then I do Y and then Z. And what it does, it takes this bracket and moves it over here. This is W tensor X tensor Y tensor Z. Now it comes with this type of bracketing. Next, I can apply alpha now at W X and Y tensor Z. So this takes this bracket and moves it to the other side. So I'm at W tensor X tensor Y tensor Z with this type of bracketing. But now I can also first apply an alpha in here. So I do alpha W X Y and tensor this with the identity on Z. And then I just move this bracket to the other side. So I get W tensor X tensor Y. This is still in a bracket, and then tensor Z. Now I can move to the other side. I mean, I can move this bracket to the other side by applying alpha W X tensor Y comma Z, going to W tensor X tensor Y tensor Z. And now finally I can do alpha. So I can do the identity on W tensor alpha X Y Z. So this moves this bracket to this side. So there are two ways of taking a bracketing where all brackets are on the left and going to a bracketing where all brackets are on the right. And we want these two things to be equal. So the condition is that this commutes, such as this. And I mean, you don't really need to remember this condition. It's somehow, what it tells you is that you can safely ignore how to bracket things. Right? The definition is set up in such a way that you should never worry about bracket things. And we will, at some point, just like not write brackets anymore. And like there's all this complicated thing of saying what it means, but in the end, like smart people have figured out a definition which allows you to, in practice, ignore these type of annoying things. And then another definition. So C is called
I haven't fully digested this. I know the different models are sort of tensor product, and there's a categorification rule. I don't know what should I think about. I'm trying to see it.
We will do examples. So C is called strict if alpha, L, and R are identities. Okay. I mean, most operations, binary operations, you know, which you can apply to things which live in a category will give you such an example. So for example, the tensor product of vector spaces turns out to so one example is you take the category of vector spaces and take the tensor product of vector spaces. This is a monoidal category with this type. The category of vector spaces becomes a monoidal category by equipping it with the binary operation, which is taking tensor products.
So a monoidal category is a category with an extra operator.
Yes, which allows you to, which is binary, meaning you can take two inputs and one output. So tensor product is an operation which takes two vector spaces and gives you a new vector space.
Yeah.
So.
Right. What would be the one?
The ground field, like the complex numbers, if they are complex vector spaces. But if you take C tensor V, but you already see this is not equal to V as a vector space, but there's a canonical isomorphism to V.
Yeah.
It just takes lambda tensor V to lambda X on V, so scalar multiplication. Oh, right. On a basis, but this, they are not the same, but there is an isomorphism.
So we have a, you want to be able to equip a category with a, an extra piece of structure.
Yes.
That should, okay, have inherent, or tries to model the nice properties of the tensor product.
Yes.
Okay, just to summarize the properties, they would be, what does the first property say?
What property?
Well, below the definition. That's the one that you just mentioned, that there's the identity.
And then the next thing, there's the tensor product operation. Right, and then I'm saying there are isomorphisms like this, which I call R and L. And then the other thing is, right, now you can look at V tensor W tensor X. Right, this is a vector space. You can also look at V tensor W tensor X. And you can ask, are they the same vector space or not? And if you are careful with what you mean by a tensor product, you know it's not the same. Right, somehow this has a basis which looks like V tensor W tensor X.
Yeah.
And this has the basis which formally has a different bracketing here.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So they are not exactly the same, but there's a there's an isomorphism between them.
And somehow that's not enough to make the composition as good as we would like. We have to also introduce an extra notion of composition, like an extra condition on the composition.
Yeah, because, I mean, right, if you now just have this isomorphism, the problem is that now if you have a bunch of if you have, I don't know, we have X tensor Y tensor Z tensor W tensor T or something like this.
Yeah.
All right, and now I pick some order of, I should pick something which is actually, let's say this bracketing, and now I want to do something with it where I change this bracketing to like whatever, this type of bracketing, because maybe it's like something which, like the maps I apply more naturally work. So I have an isomorphism between these two things. But now, actually what turns out, I have a lot of isomorphisms between them, because there are a lot of ways of taking this bracketing, this type of bracket, and doing these type of moves to go from here to here.
Yeah.
And what you want is that all of these things give you the same map. Right? And this is what this condition implies. So this is the condition for four elements. If I have four elements, then all the types of bracketings are the corners here. So there are five ways of bracketing this thing. And then there are ways of going between them. But any way of going from a bracketing to another bracketing is like a path in this space. So I could either invert these things and go like this, or I could go like that. And the condition is that all these things give me the same map. And then there's some combinatorics you need to do, is that this condition is actually enough to ensure it for all higher things. Right now, all ways of bracketing higher things, going between them, they will all be the same as soon as these things commute.
Okay. Yeah. And physically, like, the reason why we are talking about monoidal categories is that physically, it is related with having some locality in your theory, like to
composite
systems.
It means that like you can compose systems, which is like a type of tensor product, yes.
Can you say something about like what would it mean for this associativity to not work?
I mean, it would mean if you compose system one with system two, and then the combined system with system three, this gives you a different thing than first combining system two with system three and then with system one. That makes sense. Right, somehow if you compose systems, like, right, if you have something made out of three parts, there are two ways of composing this to something made out of one. Is first, like, composing these two things with the third one, or the other way around. And if associativity would fail, these systems might be different. And there might be situations where this happens, right? I mean, there are operations which are non-associative. And there might also be physical systems which are, where, like, composing systems in different orders might give you different type of things. But here, the type of composition we have is really just, like, looking at the system at different pieces of space-time which don't talk to each other. So there it should not matter how we compose them, because they are composed in a non-interacting way. There's no interaction between them. Okay, let me list some examples and then I stop. I mean, this is, we already did this example. So what are examples? The category of sets with the tensor product just being the Cartesian product of sets as an example. The category of categories with the tensor product being the product of category, and then there's the category of vector spaces with this tensor product just being the tensor product of vector spaces. Okay, and I think I should stop here, so thanks for listening.